Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And we continue with open forum this hour. Lots and lots of calls today. So I will remind you again, if it's important to you that you want to get your call heard today, that you dial with some alacrity the number 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Open forum means if you have a question about the Catholic faith, we will do our very best to get you an answer, whether you are Catholic or not. As a matter of fact, I do not. Nick, you could help me out on this. Did we have any non-Catholic callers last hour? I don't even remember if we took any non-Catholic calls. I think we... Oh, one Protestant person. All right. So you don't even have to be Christian to call. Anybody can call. If you got a question about the Catholic faith, give us a call. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Father John Trigilio, a native of Erie, Pennsylvania, who now is outside of Pennsylvania. At the moment, That was a mistake. I was going to read the wrong location for him. He's at the seminary now. He's the host of Web of Faith and Web of Faith 2.0 on EWTN. That's probably where you know him from. He did a whole series of books for the Dummies series. And this is not meant to be... Somebody called one time and was annoyed that we... kept saying that his books are called Catholicism for Dummies, Women in the Bible for Dummies, Pope John Paul II for Dummies, Saints for Dummies. No, that's a series of books, the Dummies books. And so he is the guy that did the Catholic, a whole bunch of the Catholic of those versions of those. He earned his doctorate in medieval philosophy and a doctor of theology in biblical studies. He is a member of the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars and has been the president of the Confraternity of Catholic Clergy, a national association of 600 priests and deacons since 2002. Father John Trigilio, our guest. We got a little technical problem. That's okay. That's all right. I'll take the calls. If you want to see if Father Hugh Barber is here, but you know what happens? I have to say, when it's open forum and our open forum guest is either late or absent, then it's a free for all around here. So we can talk about it. You don't even have to ask a question. You can just call and tell us what you think about the Catholic Church, whatever, because I will do my best to be of assistance, but my best is not always as precise, let us say, as many of the apologists here. Let's go to Mike in Cleveland, Ohio, watching on Facebook Live. It has now become a free-for-all until we have an apologist or chaplain here with us. A Catholic free-for-all. For me, it's kind of fun, but for you, we'll see how you feel about it. Mike in Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland is one of my top 10 favorite Ohio cities. Watching on Facebook Live, you are up, Mike. You have a question or comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, hi. How you doing there?
Very well.
Yeah, so I was just watching this thing, and, you know, they were finding these embers and stuff like that in Myanmar province, or Myanmar or whatever. You know, there's that war going on over there, too. So anyways, they extracted these embers and stuff like that, and they're trying to get, like, proteins to find, like, DNA and stuff like that.
Oh, in ember?
Yeah, I gotcha. Like, yeah.
All right.
Now, like, has the Catholic Church had any kind of, like, ruling on anything like that? And I have another couple of questions, too. Just the other one, too, is also with the... So they actually have taken, like, the whatever part of our DNA that produces human antibodies, and they put it in the cows, too. Like, what's the church's ruling on any of that?
I just said that my answers will be less precise than many of the apologists' answers will be. And you probably are asking the question that requires the most precision for a person to ask. I'm going to say a couple things to you, and we'll see if these are helpful. First one is National Catholic Bioethics Center is kind of a clearinghouse. It's an institution designed to do exactly this, answer questions about bioethics from a Catholic perspective. And it's a perspective that can be very, very helpful. The way you locate them is you go to ncbcenter.org, ncbcenter.org. I assume when you're talking about finding DNA in embers, we're talking about prehistoric animals. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like millions of years old or something, I think
okay.
they said.
So can we bring prehistoric animals back? In other words, is Jurassic Park acceptable to a Catholic? Can we recreate Jurassic Park? I have to say, I have never heard any objection to this. I think the most recent ones are, there's some thought of regrowing a woolly mammoth, and you could do that simply by implanting the DNA from a woolly, because they're not that old. It wasn't that long ago. It was about 10, 15,000 years ago when woolly mammoths went extinct. You could put the DNA of a woolly mammoth into fertilize an elephant egg with that DNA, and then you could implant that elephant embryo into an a woolly mammoth embryo into an elephant mom. And then she could gestate that, and then you get yourself an approximation of a woolly mammoth. You wouldn't get exactly a woolly mammoth out of that deal, but you get an approximation of a woolly mammoth. I've never heard a Catholic objection to that. And I will even go one step further. I hope there is no Catholic objection to that, because I'd like to see a woolly mammoth. At least sometime while I'm still on this earth, I'd like to see a woolly mammoth. Now, the other question you asked was about altering the DNA of animals. Am I right, or did I...
It was about, so apparently they have these cows or something they managed to they put like human antibodies. Like, I don't know if they took human DNA or implanted into a cow. I don't know.
Okay. I can help you a little bit with this one. And again, I will recommend the National Catholic Bioethics Center to be helpful to you. And, I'm going to watch our sound engineer. If he gets a look of shock on his face, I'm going to say, no, I went way off the rails on that. But the general, first prohibition in altering or using any kind of human DNA is the prohibition against anything that assaults the dignity of the human person. So, for example, if the process, because there's a million different ways that experts in biology and chemistry do these things, if there were a process in which, for example, you created an embryonic human life, And that was the genetic material that you were using, that would be absolutely forbidden, not just by the Catholic Church, but by basic moral sense. That is, you don't need to be a Catholic to know that is wrong. It's wrong to create human life outside of the womb of a human mother, and it's wrong to use that human life in a way that is equivalent to murder or slavery. That is, using another person as a tool to do another thing, and that is exactly what a human embryo is a human being, a human creature, and we don't use that. But let's say what you're talking about is you weren't harvesting DNA from destroyed human life, but you could just take DNA from my hair sample or your fingernail or your blood or something. And then you use that to mix that with animal DNA to produce something. Well, that is going to depend on the reason for what you are doing and to the degree to which what you produce may in fact be a human person. So, in other words, we don't believe in post-humanism or transhumanism or improving the human race through the manipulation of the genes of people, but we do believe in curing disease. So if you were, for example, to be able to manipulate the DNA of a cow so that it would produce insulin that could be used in a human diabetic, that's a morally laudable thing. So long as those other prohibitions I'm talking about, that prohibitions on damaging or degrading or destroying human life or doing things that are offensive to human dignity. So it's... Again, this is something where very fine moral distinctions need to be made. We're not very good in our age at making those fine moral distinctions, so we can assume that lots of things that are outrageous have already been done, are being done now, or will be done in the future. But in general, manipulating DNA or changing DNA as for therapeutic purposes, and as long as we're not doing things that offend human dignity or assault human life, that's going to be okay, because there are such things as genetic diseases or diseases that changing an animal's DNA, as I said, to do something like to produce human antibodies or to produce insulin that would be usable for humans would be acceptable. Mike, I'm going to leave it there and I'm going to take a break because my good friend, Father Hugh Barber, is going to be here to clean up this train wreck in just a moment. So we'll take a break and we'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I just wanted to thank the station for being there on the radio for all of us Catholics. We're all trying to learn something new every day about ourselves and about the world we live in and the people that we interact with. Thank you for taking my question. I appreciate your willingness to be on the radio these days.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. I am Cy Kellett, your host. A little technical problem with connecting with our very good friend, Father John Trigilio. And so we have had to invite a, well, let's say another very well-prepared priest, certainly. Father Hugh Barber is our chaplain here at Catholic Answers. And do you want me to do the, want me to go through all the degrees?
No,
or should we just
no,
say,
no, just,
he can do this.
Always at hand.
And if you were...
Our old abbey used to say that getting degrees is like being a Christmas tree. They'd hang things on you.
Oh, yeah, they just...
So that they can fall off later on.
Well, I'm glad to have you here because I am inadequate to the task of answering many of the questions that we get here. And but you were...
Don't write yourself a bad script.
You were...
Sure you do fine.
You were hunched over Latin tomes. We had to find... They had to find you somewhere and you were hunched
yeah,
over
I,
your
I
Latin...
Was, I was chewing on a leaf of a manuscript, yeah.
Is that what you were
meditating,
doing?
Meditating, yes.
Well, thank you for giving up your studies in Latin and coming here to
Inscriptions,
help us out.
I have to finish with Father Justin.
Are you working on inscriptions mm-hmm. for the new abbey?
Yes, right.
So an inscription, that's they're going to like carve these things that you're writing, you're going to carve them into the walls of the
They'll
abbey?
They'll be in like some kind of paint or mosaic.
They're
or
literally going to put your well words in stone.
If they decide they want them. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming to help us. Let's go to Kathy in Texas, listening on 98.3 FM Guadalupe Radio. Kathy, you're lucky because you don't have to listen to my answer. You get Father Hugh's answer. Your question, please. Hi, Kathy. No? Oh, all right. Well, apparently we had a switch on line five if you want to check that. But let's go to Bobby in New Orleans, Louisiana, listening on 690 AM. And Kathy, if you're there, don't worry. We'll get back to you. Bobby in New Orleans, Louisiana, your question for Father Hugh Barber.
Hey, how you doing? I'd like to ask a couple of questions that I like outside the box because my brother died in December.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. I was reading an almanac that talked about a study on near-death experiences by a Dr. Kenneth Ring in Connecticut. And in there, he had said stuff like people underwent a brief but powerful thrust into a higher state of consciousness. And the near-death experiences varied in length, intensity, but followed similar patterns. People underwent them, reported an abrupt separation from their bodies, and were looking down upon themselves. Their pain dissolved, and they were overwhelmed by an inexpressible peace and contentment. Many said they entered a tunnel of darkness and moved toward a brilliant white light that emitted warmth and love. And they were flooded with knowledge beyond their ordinary capabilities and discerned the pattern or the meaning of life. They said it didn't matter if it was children or different religious backgrounds, they all reported the same thing. So, that's one of my questions. What do y'all have to say about that?
Ah, okay. So near-death experiences.
Well, one thing to remember about near-death experiences is that they're near death. They're not the same as death. So mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense that you know, we're body and soul, but the relationship between body and soul is varied throughout life. And sometimes we're more conscious of the activity of our body, and other times we're conscious of the activity of our operations, which are basically just mostly have to do with the spiritual soul. And so in preparation for death, the human composite, the human person, gradually is prepared for death through the experience of the gradual things that lead up to the separation of the soul and body. So when you say, are these experiences real? It would appear that they are, but the important thing is to recognize how to interpret them. Because this experience, for example, of being able to see yourself in bed, you know, from the ceiling or from some higher point, you have to remember that if the soul is not separated from the body completely, there still is a very strong functioning of the imagination and a focus there. So it's not necessarily that the soul is actually separated and looking back down on the body, but that rather the soul is being prepared, maybe through the help of the angels or whatever, to the idea that it's going to be separated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a very important and catastrophic event. Death is a violence as far as our human nature is concerned, since we're meant to be body and soul together. And so it would make sense that in God's providence, there must be means that are natural that accompany the experience of death, at least in people who don't die absolutely suddenly, that help them to make the transition without being troubled or anxious. Because, of course, what you're really preparing for is at the moment of death, when the soul and body are definitively separated, then you have the particular judgment, which is something very serious. And so I think it's a merciful disposition of God. But it shouldn't be interpreted as though someone has actually died and come back, because people come back and describe these things.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're describing the preliminary psychological experiences that go before death. And it's nice to know that God in his providence, maybe with the help of the angels, has made it so that it's not as terrifying as we would think. But in preparation for a very serious examination, which we all know in our catechism is a particular judgment, where we will be examined on the content of our life very quickly by the Lord, but very incisively.
So, Bobby, you had a follow-up that you wanted to ask?
A different question, because I'd like to know your opinion of this, and I'm talking outside the box now, okay?
Sure.
Because, like, in about 1990, I saw a, quote-unquote, what they call a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very extremely large thing. It had made no sound at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was not hallucinating. It started and stopped where craft of this earth cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
It took off at unbelievable.
Well, not yet, at least.
Couldn't even see it. Yeah, well, this was in the 80s or 90s, so you would have thought the technology would be out by now. Yeah. The only thing is maybe a hologram, you know what I mean, if you try to get...
Sure. Well, so the fact is that these things that people see, I mean, the fact is that we found out, and it's been on the news, Tucker Carlson on Fox actually covers this stuff.
Oh, really? I didn't know. He found out
that actually the Department of Defense does look into these experiences of these, what are they called? They don't say UFO. They have another expression for it.
I don't know. But Jimmy Akin covers it all the time.
Something or other.
Right.
But I mean, so they do take it seriously to the point that they do look into all these things. So, mm-hmm. you know, who's to say, but certainly if those who have the equipment and the technology to investigate these things closely with any possibility of being able to tell exactly what they are, if they are, they're certainly not going to tell us. So, I mean, you don't think the Defense Department is going to tell us, oh, yeah, this was real. They're not going to do that.
Right.
But in any case, who knows if it's from another planet or, you know, I personally find that hard to believe, but another planet, or that it has something to do with some technology that we're in competition with in some other part of the world. But it's possible.
I hope that's satisfying to you, Bobby. Thank you very much. Those questions aren't so outside the box. We're happy
to
take
those
questions.
No, they're actually at the periphery of the box.
I got to follow up on one thing, though, because you said a very precise examination. Or how did you phrase it?
A particular judgment, which is our personal judgment before the Lord.
Right.
Just Jesus and
but nobody ever comes back and talks about that, or do they?
Well, occasionally you have purgatory stories where you find out about it, but the most beautiful account of it that you can find is in Pope Benedict's encyclical on hope, Spe Salvi. He has a beautiful passage on the nature of the particular judgment and its relationship to purgatory and all that. But that's what we're preparing for, because it's sort of like, you know, you bring the kid to the pediatrician and you give him the highlights book and the lollipop and you do all these nice things.
I see what you're saying.
You know, these calm them down.
Yeah, stay calm.
So that, because they're going to get examined, you know.
And it's going to be
easy. a little bit dramatic. So it's a preparation. God doesn't do things with human beings, at least, with discrete, sudden, you know, jolting shifts.
He's careful
generally
with
speaking,
us.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so I have to say I have some personal...
Except when he does, actually.
Yeah, right. With St. Paul, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
But I have some personal interest in this, because I have the suspicion that I'm going to die someday. And so I carry that around with me. All right, so when you say particular judgment, do you mean that, like, we'll review today and tomorrow?
Yes,
and
then
really?
Yeah.
That makes me think I should probably do a better job.
But it should not be a cause for anxiety, because remember, the one who is judging you has a complete and exhaustive knowledge of you and all your experiences, weaknesses, accommodations, better than any psychotherapist whom you pay to give details of your life.
I do believe that.
So that he can put things together.
Right.
But Jesus knows it all.
Yeah.
And so his judgment is going to be merciful. Now, granted, probably the particular judgment, if you follow the fathers of the church, will be the demons trying to make a case for themselves that, you know, accusing us and so on. But they won't have any support if we've been faithful to Our Lady and our guardian angel throughout the course of our life. So main thing is to pray to Our Lady now and at the hour of our death and our guardian angel.
Okay, fair enough. You gave me a poem to read by John Henry Newman one time. I read it. It was magnificent. Do you remember the name of it? It was about
The Dream of Gerontius.
The Dream of Gerontius, the depiction
of death. Yeah. That has to be in Christian literature. That's one of the, if you want to read what it's like, if we can say what it's like, that is a magnificent presentation.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Dream of Gerontius, Gerontius.
Yeah, it's good.
Look it up, Google it.
Somebody should make a movie of it.
Yeah.
All right, let us go now to Aishu in Temple, Texas. I'm not familiar with Temple, Texas, but I'm happy to have you here. Aishu, your question for Father.
Yes, I have a question about in vitro fertilization. My son's godfather and his wife have 4 children. They're all born through in vitro fertilization, and they use the surrogate mom to carry the babies. And we got to know about this only after the surrogate mom was already pregnant with the baby. The first was like a set of twins, and they are godchildren. And I am just really confused.
About IVF?
I'm confused, because they keep telling us that they are blessed to have these children, which I think that is correct. But I think it's IVF is mortal sin, according to my understanding, and I just don't know if I'm in a mortal sin for not admonishing them.
All right, let me ask Father time. But
yeah, but I would say first thing is, if you're the godmother, your main duty is to watch over the children's education in the faith and encourage them to practice the faith and the use of the means of grace, you know, the sacraments and prayer, devotion to Our Lady, those things. And to the extent to which you can enlighten their parents who have already done this, you have to look at whether it's possible to do that or not, because they may not be able to understand or appreciate what you're saying, and someone may have given them bad advice, even a priest perhaps. So I said that's just something you have to approach with a certain delicacy, because you don't want to be cut off from the kids that of whom you're the godmother. On the other hand, I would say just pray, ask Our Lady that the issue could be brought up sometime in a context where you could actually tell them what the church teaches, because they themselves inquired, and just look for it there. But I wouldn't anxiously look for, you know, I wouldn't like anxiously say I have to run and tell them this, unless they're going to do it again. If they're going to do it again and you know about it, then you should do what you can to stop it, because, of course, the IVF produces a number of embryos, not just one.
Right.
So I would say if they're going to do it again and you find out about it, then you should lovingly intervene, explaining that, of course, every human life is a blessing and that the children are all blessings for sure, because God doesn't subtract the laws of his nature just because someone has sinned in conceiving a child, where a lot of children wouldn't exist today. And so consequently, you know, I mean, that's really true. So,
yeah,
but
right.
I would say if they're going to do it again and you know it, then pray carefully and try to help them. But otherwise, I would kind of lay low and concentrate on the kids.
Aishu, thank you so much for that call. We appreciate it. 888-31-TRUTH, the number here. It is open forum. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Right back with more of that right after this. Bye.
This is Dale Alquist of the American Chesterton Society, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn. Did you know that you can have me and other Catholic Answers speakers headline your next conference or parish event? Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com to get all the information you need to book one of our dynamic speakers today. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com.
So, you're listening to Catholic Radio. I think it's safe to say that you probably want to become like Jesus. Theosis is a fancy word used to explain the process of becoming like Christ. It's how God takes sinners like you and me and transforms us into who we were created to be. Basically, rockin' saints. Clumsy Theosis is a podcast where I take 2,000 years of Catholic goodness, draw from the great minds and spiritual masters of the church, boil it down, distill it, and give practical advice to 21st century Christians. Basically, we'll learn how to do this Catholic thing like a boss. Subscribe to Clumsy Theosis wherever good podcasts are found.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Today, this hour, Father Hugh Barber and I, we're taking your calls. And we're answering your questions. It's a team effort. The two of us working together.
Absolutely.
It is a team effort. If you get stuck, you just send it over to me, Father.
I'll do that. I won't hesitate.
No, please don't. Let's go to Andrea in Grand Island, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Andrea, delighted to have you with us. Your question for Father.
Yes, I was wondering about tithing. I was born and raised Catholic, and my husband and I be married 17 years, and our oldest child is going to be going to Catholic middle school next fall. And I was trying to find resources on tithing and the percentage that should go to the church versus could some of it be used towards Catholic education, and asking for some guidance on that.
Oh, okay. So what about tithing as Catholics?
Well, tithing, tithing is a ritual law of the Old Testament. So those laws don't, unlike the moral laws, like the Ten Commandments, the ritual laws don't bind exactly as they're written. But the tradition has been, and the encouragement in Christian tradition was that the faithful should tithe, that is, give a tenth of their net income to the support of the church and her ministers. But In point of fact, the church doesn't make any such specific requirement today. That is, you're required, as one of the commandments of the church, to support the church and her ministers and so on, but it doesn't say the percentage. So it's better if one does as much one could do generously. And what I'm getting to is that other causes which are also Catholic, it seems to me, would count. That it doesn't have to be. The old approach was, we're talking about the pastor of your parish church and your parish church and your parochial school, and that's it. And they guarded that rather zealously. But in point of fact, it would seem like today, and even before, there's a certain freedom to support good causes. But I think the standard of 10% is obviously a biblical indication, scriptural indication, of what would be reasonable. And one might strive to move in that direction, but it doesn't have to be just to your parish and your parochial school. It can be to charitable causes, Catholic religious orders, apostolates like Catholic Answers, other efforts to promote and to convey the Catholic faith and practice. So, but that's something where you discern with your spouse, and just carefully recognize that we're asked by the Lord to give a bit of our substance, not just of our excess. And of course, anyone that runs a household goes, what excess? where's the extra that I'm supposed to be, you know, giving in addition to my substance? So most of us are in a position where we're going to be giving from our substance no matter how much we give. So just, and I remember the story of the widow who gave her mite. You know, our Lord was not there asking them, you know, to calculate their 10%.
But she could give to Spirit Catholic Radio, her local Catholic radio.
She certainly
network.
May. Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be okay.
Yeah. All right. Absolutely.
Okay. And could you explain something to me?
Yes.
You probably already said this, but before taxes or after taxes? I know that's a dumb question. It seems kind of selfish maybe to ask that question. But
I said net.
Okay. All right. I'm maybe slightly financially illiterate. Net means
what you actually get.
What you actually get. After Caesar took his slice.
I would say, yeah, right, sorry.
Okay, all right.
I mean, at least, you know, but I'm saying that there is no strict legal obligation in canon law or whatnot. St. Thomas says that Christians are not bound to tithe as they were in the Old Covenant, because it would seem that in the New Covenant, they would be so motivated by charity that they would give even more than 10%. That's what St. Thomas says.
I like that, St. Thomas.
But that's never been church law.
Sounds like a Dominican to me. Jack. Oh, well, Andrea, I didn't say thank you. Thank you very much for that.
Well, they're
call.
A mendicant order. They have to beg for their existence. Yeah.
Right. I think Catholic Answers is a mendicant order, too.
Yes, definitely.
We have to Here beg for our existence. Jack in San Jose, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Jack, your question for Father Hugh Barber.
Hey, Shai. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Happy to.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, great to
Wonderful,
have you, Jack.
Great.
God bless you, Father. My question is regarding if a relative passed and you know that she's holy or at least close to Christ, and you want to pray to her for a miraculous healing, would that be okay? And would it be safe to say that the miraculous thing happened, that is it safe to say that she is in heaven?
Well, I would say, you know, if you can ask your relative to pray for you while she's still alive, you can certainly ask her to pray for you after she's died. That is, it's the same. So if she was a good holy woman and you asked for prayers in her lifetime, then certainly you can ask her after she died. And whether she's in heaven or not, it would seem like a pretty good chance that she is, especially if a miracle was worked by her prayers. But we don't really know that detail, because we don't know exactly the manner in which God might enlighten the souls of the departed in our regard. So it may be that some souls in purgatory can pray for us, but normally we would assume that if they're praying for us, they're in heaven. Yeah, so your basic assumption is correct. St. Thomas says about the souls in purgatory that they're rather to be prayed for than to be prayed to. But he doesn't rule it out absolutely completely. But I would say if your holy relative has prayed for you and you've gotten graces from her intercession, probably she's in heaven. Yeah, I would say that.
It's an awful good sign.
That's the standard the church uses. There have to be miracles to declare a saint. So that's your own private belief, of course, but it's perfectly reasonable.
Jack, thank you very, very much. Let's go now to Sean in Virginia, listening on Christendom College Radio. All right, Christendom College. Glad to have you, Sean. Your question for Father.
Thank you. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your program. My question is, I have many friends who are Protestants and family members who are Protestant as well, and I remember we were having a conversation last week, and I remember this when I was a little younger. There were some dialogue going on between Protestant denominations and the Catholic Church regarding some forms of reconciliation, and I don't really remember the details, and so I thought I'd call and ask, are there any Protestant faiths that are in the process of reconciliation, or are there any Protestant churches that have a different status in the eyes of the Catholic Church?
Well, there is the case in the last, say, 15, well, actually since 1980, but more immediately in the last 15 years or so, of the so-called Anglican Ordinariate set up by Pope Benedict, which was set up within the Catholic Church to receive Anglicans, that is, Episcopalians, the English Protestants, into the Catholic Church, allowing them also to maintain certain aspects of their tradition and patrimony. And so that's sort of a model of what sort of right-thinking Catholics have in mind, that is, the Church respectfully acknowledging the good things that exist in their tradition, even those good things which came about after their separation from the Catholic Church, but recognizing also their desire to be in full communion, full sacramental communion with the Church. So that exists, and there's certain dialogues that exist between the Catholic Church and the Protestant churches. There are also some Lutherans who are interested in a similar consideration. And of course, the Church regularly receives non-Catholic ministers and their wives and ordains them priests. There are a good number of former Protestant ministers of various stripes who have been ordained priests in the Catholic Church and around the country, several hundreds, in fact. But as far as dialogue go, there are official dialogues between the different churches. Those tend not to have a lot of resonance on the grassroots level. They're mostly right. Theological dialogue and whatnot. But I think that one of the best things that we can recognize is that the real dialogue has occurred in the common efforts on the part of Christians to maintain the Christian and moral status of our society through, for example, the pro-life movement and through various efforts to assist families and to promote Christian marriage and Christian life generally and young people and so on. So I think some of those dialogues might be better accomplished simply by common efforts to maintain the Christian character of our civilization.
Sean, thank you very, very much for that call. It is open forum, and we have one line open right now, and we might be able to get you in, 888-31-TRUTH. Father Hugh Barber, our guest this hour, it's the month of Mary. May is the month of Mary. If you haven't done something for Mary this month yet, go ahead and maybe think of something you might want to do for our Heavenly Mother. We've got a book we want to give you. It's called Queen of Heaven, Ever Virgin, Full of Grace. It's an ebook, and it's free. And you get that ebook just by going to shop.catholic.com, and you click on the banner that says Queen of Heaven, and then you get a free ebook, Queen of Heaven, Ever Virgin, Full of Grace.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The reason people should listen is so they can get excited about the faith and then share that faith with others. Because that's what it's about. When we say, Jesus says, come follow me, but he also said, go and make disciples. We'll give you the tools needed for the new evangelization. Because that's the call to bring everyone into a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Open Line with Father Larry Richards, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Father Hugh Barber, our guest. Some crazy technical things going on in the studio, but we'll muddle through for the last segment. I think we'll be able to get to callers and get you on the line. St. Joan of Arc, I just want to ask you a quick question about St. Joan of Arc. Does she have a feast day on the calendar anymore, or do they get rid of it?
No, they don't get rid of saints' feast days.
Oh, sorry.
The church has a giant martyrology in which all her saints are listed, and they have different days of the year. But some saints are not in the universal calendar that you see, like in your Magnificat or your Missal.
Right,
or
right.
Whatever. But they're celebrated. Like in France, her feast day is coming up, May 29th. So...
Okay, so here's the deal.
May 29th to 30th is one or the other.
I'm glad I got to ask you because Daniel from Memphis sent me a letter and a very nice card of Joan of Arc.
And great with the sort of pre-Raphaelite.
Exactly, area. Right. And he said he wanted me to mention that she still has a feast. So I thought I'd ask you about it. So
I think it's May 29th.
He says May 30th here
May
30th, in the letter.
Okay, May 30th, yeah. It's around there.
But anyway. That'll be the Feast of the Ascension too here. So... anyways, I just want to mention Joan of Arc because I love Joan of Arc. I think Joan of Arc is a miracle. And so he said, well, mention her to people because he loves her. And so all right, Daniel, don't forget Joan
She's
of Arc.
She's a great saint. She's a great saint. And she waited patiently for her canonization.
She did.
Politics intervened.
She had to wait patiently.
So 1925, think of it, from the 1400s to 1925.
She
and she was burned at the stake.
She didn't have good luck with
persecuted.
Oh, I know.
Still waited.
I know, but a part of it had to do with the rediscovery of the transcripts of the trial, right? When people read those transcripts, they were like, "Wow,
she was exonerated by a papal commission pretty soon after her trial,
right?
Yeah, so
right,
so she was exonerated pretty quickly, but they were waiting, and of course, she was not canonized as a martyr precisely because on both sides. Were Catholics, so they weren't persecuting each other for being Catholic.
It's hard to be.
They were just persecuting each other.
Yeah, that's right.
Sad.
Yeah, it was a political persecution that ended her life.
But God seemed to be on one side rather than the other. That seems to be the case as far as she was concerned. So
I am firmly in the camp that sometimes God does choose sides because sometimes one side or another needs
to
prevail.
He chooses the losing side a lot of the time.
He does. Mm-hmm. He does choose the losing side a lot of the time. But in that case, France... she had a role to play in the coming centuries, let's say.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
That thank God that Joan of Arc preserved her to play right. that role. Okay, we got Daniel. Thanks for the chance to talk about one of my favorites, Joan of Arc. Teresa in Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. If the phones are working, you'll be there. Are you there, Teresa?
Yes, I am.
All right, wonderful. Your question for Father.
I've got a question on confession. My husband and I have been married for 29 years, and we're both born and raised Catholic. I had stepped away from the church for quite a few years, and he has too. We have recently came back to our faith and been attending Mass. He's divorced, so eventually he'll have to start as a nomad. My question is during this time, I feel that... I really need to take confession, but I know it's a sacrament, and I want to know if I'm able to do that since I am not able to do certain or take on certain sacraments because of our predicament in our marriage.
Okay. Well, in a marriage, if you're living as brother and sister, I'm not going to ask you if you are, but if you are, then that takes care of that. And so, yes, you can certainly go to confession in the meantime, but of course, with the idea that you're avoiding the near occasions of sin, you're trying your best to live according to the moral law. So, but you can certainly go back to confession. I would recommend it actually to give it a try.
Give it a try going back to confession.
Yeah, certainly. And but recognizing that may be your movement or desire of this heart to go to confession might be a movement also to bring your personal relationship, your spouse into line with the teaching of Christ in the church, you know, sooner rather than later.
Okay, Teresa?
Part of it. That's going to be part of what we're going to do is get married in the church.
Right.
But again, you know, we just feel that we want to be able to take on, you know, at least confession since
right.
we can't take communion until
sure.
after
well, being you could take communion if you're not making use of the rites of marriage until you're married in the church. So you could take communion even if you go to confession and you're going to live as a brother and sister. Otherwise, then you need to wait. Yeah.
Teresa, thanks very much. I like the way you talk, Father. I like that. Making use of the rights of marriage. I got to remember that one.
Yeah, well.
You
have to say things nicely.
Yes, not everyone does, though. But
no.
Not everyone does. I think that society makes us a little crass, and then we get in that habit. And you always make a good point. I always like this thing, too, that there are certain things that even when you're talking about them at Mass, you should use a language that respects that this is the Mass, too.
Right.
Like as a priest, for example, preaching, people say, well, why doesn't our priest talk more about abortion? Well, maybe he shouldn't use that word. He should talk about it, but he shouldn't use that word.
Or he can use it in a homily, but I think liturgical prayers, I think the vocabulary should be on the line with whatever you would find in a collect in the Roman Missal.
Yeah.
Use that kind of language. So we don't have to use the word abortion, pornography, these kind of things in prayers that are liturgically recited. You say, for those who are not yet born, that their lives may be protected and cherished.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that actually makes people think about it more than rather putting up a red flag with a very crass word.
Which
they're ugly words that people didn't used to say. I mean, I remember when I was a child, divorce was a word people didn't say out loud.
Oh, really?
Like in front of kids, they say, well, they got, and then your mother would go, divorce.
Like she would just kind of mouth it.
Say it in front of the children.
Yeah.
And so, but now we just say all these things, and there are other ways of, like failed marriages or, you know, all these. You can say things in a nicer way that makes people pensive and doesn't put them on the defensive.
Right. Paul in Harding, New Jersey. I'm hoping that the phone is working. Paul, are you there with us? Oh, that was going to be close. That one was close. Let's try David in San Antonio, Texas. We've been having luck in Texas. David, are you there with us?
I'm here.
Hi, David.
Hello, David.
Your question for Father.
Yes, Father. I was curious, like with along the border here, you always hear of abductions. And I was just curious, when somebody's abducted and you're not sure about the status, but you assume that they're not to be found.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to they're obviously not going to get a Catholic burial. So what are the responsibilities of the family concerning that? And what happens to the person who's, you know, essentially missing and probably dead after they've been gone a certain amount of time?
Yeah.
Well, of course the family, if the body cannot be found or recovered, still the family should have the Holy Mass celebrated, you know, Mass for the dead, for the departed, even in the absence of the body. That's very, very common practice. And that you do all the prayers of the church that are normally done, even though the body can't be present. But of course, normally people wait until it's pretty certain that the person is actually dead. We see this also in wars and other contexts. But you can always have Mass for the intentions of any person, living or deceased. And that's the essential part of the funeral Mass, or for any other observance in favor also of the living. You may want a Mass for their recovery or in the hopes that they're not dead and that they'll be found. But no, there's no responsibility to the family. They don't have to wear themselves out trying to find the body if it's going to be impossible. But they can make occasional inquiries, because sometimes these remains are picked up in the desert by the authorities, and so they might be able to be found. But yeah, it's really sad.
David, thank you very, very much for that call. I'm going to keep moving because we got to try to get everybody in if we can, and we got some phone things going on. James, are you there with us?
I am.
All right, James, your question for Father.
Okay, a little bit of background. The woman in my life is pregnant with my child, and she is definitely having some wild mood swings, I guess.
Okay. Mm-hmm. James, just a little more directly into the phone if you can. So you are in a relationship with a woman. She's pregnant and she's having severe mood swings.
Yes. And I need some direction on some patience or endurance or how to, approach this spiritually as well as practically, I guess.
Yeah, how to be patient with your wife. Or
well, first
in this
of
case,
all, the first thing that needs to be done as far as patience goes is examine what it is you could do to help her situation, because if she's bipolar or is really severely affected psychologically by the pregnancy, you know, then there's some outside help needed and some careful attention to what kind of medication she might need or what kind of balancing of her hormonal life and all that. And so that would be the most prudent thing to do. It's important to be patient, but it's also important to be prudent.
Get help.
To get help,
yeah,
for the situation if you can. And then, of course, in terms of patience, I think there, control of the tongue is probably the main thing. Not giving in to goading, or if she's unreasonable or, you know, accusatory or angry at you or something, that you just don't respond with any kind of harsh words, but just respond patiently and sweetly to her. And then also that you don't, so that's the one thing, the tongue. And then the other part is don't turtle, you know, don't just withdraw
go into
yourself,
your shell, yeah,
and just say, I can't take this, and then kind of ignore her, avoid her, because she does need your company, even if she may not act like it all the time. And there's also an ambiguity there, because when women suffer in pregnancies, and the man who is the father of the child is there, well, as you describe, you know, this part of her is thinking, gee, I wouldn't be in this fix if it weren't for him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't feel this crazy.
Right.
And so she may have to struggle with just kind of irrational resentment. And we have to remember, the devil is constantly working on people to put them at odds with each other and to make them resentful and contrary. So I would say, be prudent and see if what helps you can get. Then also be very, very careful with the use of the tongue, and keep in mind that she's being assailed, not just by her own bodily issues, but also by the evil one trying to break things apart. So for that, you need prayer, particularly prayer to the holy angels, and getting to confession and regularizing your situation, because I have the impression that you're not really married at the moment. That's my impression. So maybe you want to look into that. But I wouldn't get married now. I'd definitely be careful about the situation now. But
yeah,
but look into the making your situation more in line with what would be expected of Christians.
What do you think, James?
I think that's great advice. What I'm worried about mostly is that, you know, she does bring up that, like, she's really scared that I'm going to abandon her. And that's
right.
That's not my intention at all. And
no.
it really worries me that I can't, reassure her that that's not going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah, well, give her as much access to you as is reasonable when you're not at home. And you know, be maybe a little more accountable than you normally would be, so that she doesn't worry. But just reassure her. But remember, the fear that she has is largely not reasonable. It's simply on the level of her passions and emotions. And so you're not going to be able to argue against it straight on. You're going to be able to confront it simply by your reassuring and kind patience with her. As you mentioned, that's what you have to show. And that doesn't always succeed. You know, be patient on a number of occasions, and she won't respond, and she'll get more irrational even though you're trying to be patient. But that doesn't mean you should give up on being patient. You have to keep up, because if not you, who? You know, you're the one that has to be patient, so you can't give up.
You better do it, James.
I'm just saying. Right. And you're a good man, obviously, or you wouldn't be asking these questions.
All right, James.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure. God bless you.
Thank you. I'd add, if I'm allowed to, a little bit of prayer to St. Joseph never hurt.
Oh, yeah. I mentioned the angels, but St. Joseph would be a good one.
Yeah. St. Joseph, many trials in his life, he overcame with gentleness and patience.
Yes.
And toughness, too. He's a pretty tough guy, that Joseph.
Yeah.
Father, thank you for the rescue.
No problem.
Jesus is my Savior, but you're my rescuer today. can I have your blessing? Can we all have your blessing, please?
Benedictio Dei Omnipotentis, Patris et Filius Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos et mania et semper.
Amen. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being with us. Don't forget, we do this every day. We'll be back tomorrow for more Catholic Answers Live. God willing, join us then.